Hello, everybody. Welcome to the first lecture, Why Capitalism? I thought for a while I could make this a very short lecture, even course, by just saying the question is why capitalism, so I could just say why not, but they probably wouldn't approve of that at the Mises Academy, so I'll have to go on with a more expanded talk than that. Now, I just want to say a few preliminary remarks for those of you who haven't taken any of my courses at the Mises Academy before, or any courses from the Mises Academy. What I do in these lectures, I usually lecture for about an hour, and then the rest of the time is for questions, discussions, refutations of what I say. And you can also ask questions or make comments while the lecture is going on. You just put them in the chat room, but I don't guarantee that I'll respond to all of them till after the lecture. That'll just depend on what the question is and where I am in the lecture. And then also, for those of you who want to take the course for credit, there's a voluntary quiz each week. This normally consists of 10 multiple choice questions. I try to make exams easy. I'm not trying to trick people. It just gives me some idea of how successful or unsuccessful I've been in explaining the material. So it shows me what I need to do better. So that's at least one reason I give the quizzes, in addition to, of course, giving you a chance to take them if you want to see how you're doing, or you want, I think you get a special certificate if you pass, take all the quizzes. I don't think anybody's ever failed any of the quizzes, so don't worry about taking them. And I've been giving about 18 or 19 courses, so it's a pretty good chance you're going to do well in them. Now, this course, I hope, attracts more people, because I think it's really a course that might be of interest to a lot of people. It's basically an introductory course in Austrian economics. Now, for some of you who've taken other courses I've given, say, on human action or Murray Rothbard's History of Economics or Mises' Epistemology, we're dealing with fairly difficult stuff. Human action isn't bedtime reading for most people. Maybe it is if they've got insomnia, but for most people it isn't bedtime reading. But the material we're covering in this course is quite easy to understand, but if you take the course, you'll get a good background in some of the basic concepts that you can use in other courses in Austrian economics. So I think, I'm hoping, please tell all your friends, take the course, or maybe I hope they'll still be your friends if they follow that advice. Something didn't happen right here. Here we go. Okay, so we're going to be talking about why capitalism? And the first question that comes up is, why use the term capitalism? We know what we mean by capitalism. It's a free market economy, the economic system in which all production takes place through voluntary activities. People have private property, and they're free to make contracts with one another, say, to produce goods and services or to work for others, strictly on a voluntary basis. There's no government or central body coordinating the process of production. So it's pretty clear what we mean by capitalism, but why should one call it capitalism? And there appears prima facie to be an argument against calling it capitalism, calling the free market capitalism, in that Capitalism is a name invented by the opponents of the free market. Mises suggests that Karl Marx is the first one to use the term capitalism. As I think there are a few mentions of the term before Marx used it, but he was the one, in his famous book, Das Kapital, first volume came out in 1867, it's the only volume that came out in his lifetime. He emphasized the role of the capitalist, and he talks about the capitalist a great deal. And later writers, such as Werner Zombart, who was started off as a Marxist but wound up sympathetic to Nazism, had a book on modern capitalism. He used it, Jews and Capitalism was a book that he wrote. I gave a lecture on mentioning that one last year. And Max Weber took over the term capitalism, the Protestant ethic and the spirit of capitalism. So the term came into use, but it was invented by opponents of capitalism. But Mises wants to use it, and I think we'll see why during this lecture, because the role of capital goods, accumulations of goods that you use to produce other goods, tools and machinery, and the money, the capital that you use to value these goods and to buy them is very important for Mises. So I think that's why he was willing to use the term capitalism. I should say there's some libertarians today don't like the term, the so-called left libertarians don't like capitalism. They say they're against capitalism, but in this respect, as in others, they weren't in accord with Mises. Now, one way I think we can see what Mises' view of capitalism is by contrasting it with the view held by Karl Marx. Now, Marx had a very interesting theory of history where he thought that the history, all of history from the ancient world up to the present time, he was writing 19th century, was a history of exploitation. And what he mean by that? Well, he thought that in all of history, in the ancient world, also in the Middle Ages, there was a class of people who produced goods and services. In the ancient world, it would be the slaves. Of course, you also had peasants and others who were producing things, but Marx says the ancient world was based on slavery. So this is the productive class that was being forced to produce for the benefit of a ruling class. Say we had the aristocrats, or the slave owners in the ancient world. So they weren't producing anything, but they would get a surplus value, as Marx called. They would get surplus from the producing classes. So they were exploiting these producing classes. And similarly, in the Middle Ages, the serfs, the agricultural workers, the peasants who were tied to the land, were the producers, and the nobles were extracting surplus from them. So again, we have exploitation. And it's pretty clear what Marx meant by exploitation is that one class is doing all the work and the others are living off this work, and they're not in that arrangement because the producers like that. They just say, well, we want to produce, we like this idea of producing for the benefit of the nobles or the king. After all, they are above us, so we want to help them out. No, it's that they're being forced to do so. If they don't produce, then the upper class is going to use violence against them. Now, I think it's interesting to note here that Mises agreed with this analysis. he agreed that the ancient world and the Middle Ages were systems of exploitation. So here he's agreeing with Marx. He thinks that this is the right way to view these systems. They're based on one group exploiting another. There's one group that's working, and there's an upper group that isn't working but just taking things from them. Now, of course, when I say he agreed with Marx, this doesn't commit Mises to accepting the details of Marx's analysis of these systems. But he agrees that before capitalism, the systems of economic systems, ancient slavery and feudalism, were based on exploitation. So far we've got Marx and Mises are in accord, not entirely. They have different ways of looking at the Middle Ages and slavery, but they're agreeing that there's exploitation. Now, where they differ is on the economic system that's the subject of this course, namely capitalism, the free market. Mises says that capitalism breaks with past systems, that capitalism is not based on exploitation of the producing class. And remember, the previous system, slavery in the ancient world and Middle Ages, are based on exploitation because there's one class that's doing all the work and there's an upper class that isn't exploiting the producers. So Mises says capitalism isn't like that. Now, it would appear, just if you're looking at the legal situation, it appears Mises is obviously right, because we don't have laws under capitalism that say workers have to work for capitalists, or we don't have laws that say there's a privileged class of people who have a different set of laws that apply to them, that they get a whole lot of rights, and then other people just have to slave away for them. We have equality under the law, that in capitalist economies, everyone has the same rights. Of course, you could say, well, capitalism is an economic system, but I'm talking about what the political system is that usually goes along with capitalism, what's characteristic of capitalism. It would be one of equal rights. You wouldn't, in the capitalist system, workers, they're free to work for capitalists or to found firms of their own, or to, they're not forced to work for anybody. But Marx said, even though that's a legal situation, that legal situation is really concealing what's going on. So in these previous systems, in ancient slavery and feudalism, the legal situation wasn't concealing what was going on. What was going on was exploitation of the producing class, and the legal system, you'd be able to see that, because there'd be different sets of regulations for the upper class and the lower class. You could just see, if you just looked at the legal system, say that serfs would be bound to work on the land, and they wouldn't have the same rights as the nobles. You could see this, but under capitalism, it appears different. But Marx said, even though it appears different, that there isn't exploitation going on, it appears that rights are equal for everybody. Marx says that isn't really true, that in fact exploitation is still going on, where exploitation means, like I said, that there's a producing class who's doing all the work, and then there's an upper class that's getting things from them, that's taking advantage of them, just getting a surplus from them without any contribution to the production. So Marx said, well, what's being concealed here? How are capitalists able to do that if you have equal rights? He said, well, workers don't have any realistic alternative to working for a capitalist employer. In effect, workers are being faced with a choice. you can work for this an employer or you'll starve. So even though they're not legally compelled to work, in effect, they still are compelled. Of course, I don't think this is a good analysis, but I'm just giving, this is the way Marx viewed matters. So he said, capitalism keeps up with this pattern of history in which the system is based on exploitation. Capitalism is just another type of exploitation. Having equal legal rights hasn't changed matters. It's retained exploitation, and Mises doesn't agree with this. And what is Mises' response to this claim that Marx is saying, look, there's supposed to be legal equality, but in fact, workers really have to work for capitalists. They're not just going to, they're not independent. They can't do whatever they want. You have to get a job in order to eat and support your family. So you're still subject to exploitation. Now, Mises has what I think is a very interesting response, very valuable response to this claim. He says that capitalism is not run by a small group of capitalists. Remember, Marx thought not only are capitalists exploiting people, but it's just kind of a small class of capitalists. There'd be a tendency under capitalism for there'd be a consolidation of firms, so the economy would be dominated by a few large firms. So Mises said, no, that's not right, even though the capitalists are the ostensible owners, they're not really the owners. So he's, it's kind of an interesting move here that Marx is saying the legal situation really conceals the real situation. The legal situation, according to Marx, is everybody's equal. Marx says, no, what's really going on is the capitalists are exploiting the workers. Now, Mises has, to counter that, he has his own claim that appearances are distorted. He said it appears that the capitalists are the ones in control because they're the owners of the firm. But he says, in fact, that isn't the case, that they're not really in control of the economic system. And how does he make out this argument? He said, well, they may be the legal owners, but he says they're not really running things. And his argument is, he says, well, businesses exist to make profits. If a business didn't try to make a profit, then it would, if it made a loss, then other people would take over the company. So you're going to have the businesses that succeed are the ones that are going to be making profits. And then if that's right, then the question comes up, how do you make profits? One way, of course, is to give lectures on capitalism, but that isn't the best way to make profit. So how do you make profit? Well, you do that by producing what the consumers want. If you can come up with something that people want, people are going to buy it, and then you'll make money, assuming your costs are below that. Of course, your costs have to be below what the revenue you're taking in, and if you want to make profit, you know the old story where somebody was saying, "I sell below cost," and someone said to him, "How do you make any money if you sell below cost?" And he said, "I make it up in volume." So that isn't the way you're going to make profit. So you have to, though. It's a necessary condition to make a profit that you produce what the consumers want. So what Mises says, a very simple point, but I think once you grasp it, you can see the force of it, is that the consumers are really in charge because businesses that satisfy them will grow and those that don't satisfy them are going to fail. So the consumer's demand is what's really running the economy. So now we have a further question. Suppose Mises is right that it's the consumer demand that really runs the economy because businesses have to please the consumers. if they want to make any money. So then we know the consumers determine what goods are produced, but we can ask which consumers. Now, some people who criticize Mises, I remember there was a British economist, Maurice Dobb, who taught at Cambridge, D-O-B-B, who was a member of the British Communist Party. So he said, well, Mises says that the consumers are running things because it's their demands that are determining profit, so they're in charge. But he said, look, this is like the rich people are much more significant in this process than poor people. We like a democracy where somebody has a whole lot of more votes than somebody else. So he said, well, rich people have more money to spend, so it's their wants that are going to determine production, not those of the poor people. But Mises said, no, that's not right, because even though a rich person has more money than a poor person, there are a whole lot of people together. If you take all the poor people together, all the people who aren't rich or just say middling income together, that's a lot of money. And production will be geared to the masses because they have in total a whole lot of money to spend. In Mises says, capitalism is geared to mass production. Of course, luxury goods are produced also. One advantage of capitalism, say, over political democracy, capitalism isn't a winner-take-all situation in which the one, say, in a political system, the one who gets the most vote wins the office, and then the one who comes in second doesn't get anything, even though if a lot of people support him, he still doesn't get anything. But in capitalism, if there's significant demand for a product going to be produced, but because the masses are, after all, there are, as the name suggests, masses, there are a lot of them, even if each person within the masses doesn't have much money, the total will be a lot of money to spend, and the system production will be geared to that. And Mises has this statement he makes a lot in his writing, that capitalism is mass production for the masses. So capitalism isn't just a system for the benefit of some elite group of consumers, and it isn't a system controlled by a small class of capitalists that's exploiting other people. Capitalism is run by the consumers, and the masses are especially important among these consumers in determining the direction of production. As I say, this is just repeating what I mentioned before, but there's no harm in saying it again, that luxuries are going to be produced. Also, I mean, say in the United States, we get a lot of luxury goods. You can find the most amazing things looking through different catalogs that you think nobody would buy, but somebody would want them. But you'll also find a lot of goods available that the great majority of people can buy. So we have now another question. We said, let's review what we had so far. We said, Mises says, the capitalists aren't really running the economy in spite of ostensibly they're the owners of the factory, so it appears they are. Mises says, well, that legal situation conceals what's really going on. It's really consumer demand that's running the economy, because the businesses, in order to make a profit, have to please those people. So then we said, well, which consumers? And we said it's in large part the masses, because they have so much money. So now we have another question is, well, if the masses have so much money, where do they get the money to buy things? And the answer to this is, in most cases, say, where would you get your own money to buy things? It's from your job. You get paid, and that gives you money to spend on whatever you want to spend it on. And if that's right, it's ultimately the workers who run things, because it's they're the consumers who want direct production. So I think what's very significant here is that the one point the socialists say is, this is a communist revolutionary said this, he said, well, we want a workers' state, and we don't want to have an economy controlled by the small group of capitalists. We want the workers to be in charge. They're the ones who produce things. And Mises responds to this. He said, well, look, under capitalism, we've already got this. The workers are running things because the workers are the consumers, and it's consumer demand that runs the system. It's a very neat way, I think, of turning the socialist argument and socialist demand for worker control against them. What Mises is saying, well, if you want worker control, you should favor the free market, you should favor capitalism, because under capitalism, the workers are running things. Now, supposing Mises is right, and I think he clearly is right, that the workers are ultimately directing production, because you remember the most consumers are workers, that's where they get their money, and it's the consumers whose demand determines production, so it's really the workers who are running things. So if that's right, if the workers are running things, then we have the question, why do people think that workers are exploited? They're the ones who are running things, but why do some people, such as Marx, say workers are exploited? Well, one reason for this, and Marx held this view, is that he thought wages couldn't rise very much above subsistence. Subsistence means what you need to stay alive and maybe to keep your family alive. So Marx said, well, look, wages won't rise above subsistence, the workers are just going to get what they barely need to live on, but there's a lot more that's being produced than that, and that's going to the capitalist exploiters. So the argument there is, well, look, we know that workers are exploited because they're not going to be earning more than subsistence. And if you're in a system where a lot is being produced, but you only get enough to eat, or what, just enough to survive, it's at least a prima facie argument you're being exploited. Of course, if you think that, we want to know why would you think that wages can't rise much above subsistence. Of course, we know now they have, so and the claim that they can't rise above subsistence is false, because we know that it's actually they actually are far above the subsistence level. But at the time people were coming up with this sort of argument, there was a very popular view among the British classical economists. You find this, say, in David Ricardo and also Thomas Malthus, was this: suppose wages go above subsistence, say workers are very productive, there's a lot of demand for the product they're making, so then the employer gives them more money, wants to attract workers to his factory so he can get more profits, then wages go up. So then the argument was, well, what's going to happen if wages go up? Then the family will be able to support more children, and they'll have a larger family, and then this having larger family will increase the labor pool, and this will drive wages back down to subsistence. So the argument in sum is, well, if wages go above subsistence for a while, then population will increase and this will drive them back down to subsistence. Of course, wages can't go below subsistence because then the workers would die and they wouldn't be available for work. So we know wages can't go much above subsistence. They can't go below it, then they're going to be at the subsistence level. That was the argument. Now, what's wrong with this argument? We know there has to be something wrong with it because it comes up with a false conclusion, namely that workers' wages are at the subsistence level. And what's wrong with it is that the view assumes that you have kind of a mechanical relationship. As soon as wages go up, say if a worker can support more children, then the family will immediately have more children. But that isn't the case. Somebody, say a family could say, oh, well, we got this extra money, we're just going to spend it on more things for ourselves, or we're going to save the money up. They don't have to have more children. And if they don't, then you're not going to have this increase in the workers' population that'll drive the wages down again. That won't happen. So their one problem with the subsistence argument is that it's just assuming that workers are going to react mechanically to this any increase in wages, and there's no reason to think that's true, and in fact, it isn't true. As I mentioned, Mises thinks that the capitalism free market is the system of mass production for the masses. He says this system is much more productive than earlier systems. It's not only that the goods are produced for the masses, but so you have a different goods, say, produced from what was the case in previous systems. Say you had under the feudal system, you'd have certain goods produced because the nobles wanted them. Under capitalism, you'll have goods produced because the masses want them. But in addition to this change in which goods are produced, the new system is more productive than earlier systems. In the earlier systems like feudalism and slavery, your position was determined at birth and things went on in a kind of a customary way. Suppose you were born a peasant, as most people were. Most people were not in the upper classes, they were in the lower class. Suppose you were born a peasant, you would almost always remain a peasant throughout your life. So there's very little scope for innovation in such a system. People are just kind of stuck in doing things in a certain way. And they'll just, sometimes you'll have improvements, say, in agricultural techniques, but basically people will be just going on the way their fathers did and their grandfathers did. They'll just be continuing the same kind of economic activities as they were brought up in, and things are going to be stagnant. Now, if we look at the economy, the British economy in the 18th century, this system where people were just doing things in a customary way and your position was basically determined by what it was when you were born. If you were born a peasant, that's what you'd be. This system reached a crisis around the middle of the 18th century. What happened was there'd been an increase in the population, and the economy wasn't able to support all the people. Before that, of course, there'd been different periods. There'd been depressions and various periods in the past, but basically, even though peasants and far lower class people weren't doing very well, at least they were getting by, but at the mid-18th century, there were a lot of people who weren't able to get by under this old customary way of doing things. And I think there were people who had nothing to do, there was no work for them, they had no means of support. And the population, I think, of England, Mises gives, different people give you different estimates about them, but Mises says the population of England was about 6 or 7 million people, and about 1 million of these people were in this position having nothing to do. They were really in a very bad way. Mises calls them proletarians in the full sense in this chapter we had to read. Now, Mises doesn't explain what he means by that, proletarian in the full sense. I think it's valuable if we examine what does he mean by a proletarian in the full sense. Well, the term proletarian comes from the Latin proletarii. This was a social class in the Roman Republic, and if you were a proletarius, meant you owned little or no property. So if you the members of this group were good only for bearing children, proles is the Latin for the children of this class. So when Mises is saying they were proletarians in the full sense, he means all they could do was reproduce themselves. There was no work for them to do. So that's what he means when he says they were proletarians in the full sense. There was nothing for them to do. So it's a little in the Roman proletarii would have work, but they wouldn't have property or very much property. So Mises is making an analogy, I think, with this meaning of the term. So it's a bit confusing because you think, well, proletarians, the proletariat, the way the word is used now, it just means workers. But when Mises say the proletarians in the full sense, he means they're just important because of their reproducing. Now, Cam says Gaius Marius found them useful. Well, no doubt he did, but I'm not going to sully this lecture by talking about him. Okay, so that was supposed to be a joke. Never mind that. Okay, so the new economy made, which was based on new factories, that say people were very enterprising, they could just start new factories and then people produce things that people wanted. So that made it possible to employ these people. Now, if you look at a lot of the writing on the Industrial Revolution that came out in the 1930s and even earlier, some of the 19th century writings like the work of Thomas Carlyle or things put by Friedrich Engels, the associate of Marx, called The Condition of the Working Class in England, the view they had, but they said, well, look, conditions in these new factories are really terrible. The workers would have to work extraordinary long hours, and they'd be women and children would have to work. They'd have very bad conditions. So what this view is, and it persisted up until in the 1930s and 1940s, historians held this, like there was J.L. and Barbara Hammond were authors who wrote on Industrial Revolution. They said, well, things were really terrible for the workers, but they're having to work under these atrocious conditions. So this shows how bad capitalism is. It was only when the government started passing legislation to help workers that things improved. So look how bad capitalism is because how terrible these working conditions were. But what's actually the case is, well, working conditions were bad if we compare them with, say, what people have today, but the crucial point to bear in mind is that people would have died under the old conditions because there was no work for them. So this was the, when they went to the new factories, they weren't being forced to go there. They were doing that because that was the best available alternative for them. And then once the system started producing more, then wages did keep going up, and that was a big trend in the 19th century. So if the workers are actually getting better, why do you have all this, these claims that things are very bad for them? Now you might think, well, the ones who would say that would be mainly socialists and other people wanting to overthrow the capitalist system. And to some extent, that's true. As I say, Friedrich Engels wrote a very influential book saying that things were really bad for the working class. But really, the main opposition to the new system came from the aristocrats, the ones who, especially people who owned the gentry, who owned agricultural land. And they didn't like the fact that workers were leaving the aristocrats' estates to work in the cities. According to the propaganda, these factories are very terrible places. But if they're that terrible, one wonders why are the farm workers or other people on the farms leaving to work in the cities? Of course, some of the people were leaving because there was no work for them on the farms, but there were also farm workers, people who worked on the estates who were leaving, and the aristocrats didn't like that. They thought, well, this is not good for us. Let's try to preserve the old system. So they were the ones who were emphasizing how bad the new system was. Okay, so we now have the question to consider, how do workers get to be well off? How do they increase their prosperity under capitalism? And both Mises and Henry Hazlitt stress this one point, is the main way a worker will increase prosperity is through increases in capital goods. By capital goods, I mean goods such as machines that are used in production. Sometimes a worker will get better just because he's more skilled in laboring. He can do things in a more skilled way than other people can. But basically, in order to become more productive, you need to be using machines and other kinds of tools. To get more prosperous, you need to use machines and other kinds of tools. And why is that? Well, in a free market economy, and this is something Mises and other Austrians talk about in not in this chapter, and exactly how this takes place, that you can get it in any of the Austrian books on economics. The wages depend on how much workers produce, so it's easy to see why this is the case, because if an employer is going to pay a worker depending on how much the worker is going to make a profit for him, so how much the worker is able to produce will determine how valuable the worker is to the employer, how much money he's going to give him. And it's increases in capital goods that makes workers more productive. So the key to making workers prosperous is to make them more productive, and the main way to do that is to give them use of more capital goods. And what's important here is the ratio of capital to workers. Suppose there's an increase in the number of capital goods, but then there's also an increase in the number of workers, that isn't going to be as good for the individual worker, because even though there's an increase in the total productivity because of the more capital goes, it'll have to be divided among more workers. And what will help the workers is if there's an increase in capital relative to the same number of workers, then those workers will be better off. So we have now that we argue that workers' prosperity depends on growth in capital goods. And why is that? Well, because what workers are paid depends on how valuable they are to the employer, how productive they are, and that what will make them more productive is using capital goods when they're working. They'll be much more productive if they have more and better machines or other tools that they use in their work. Then they, you see in economics, every question we answer, then this raises a new question. So the new question is, how do we get more capital goods? And of course, we want to answer that so we can know how the workers will become more prosperous, because they need the capital goods in order to become more prosperous. In order to get capital goods, we require savings. Why is that? Well, suppose you just consume all your wealth, you have some money and you just spend it all, or you so then you won't have anything left to invest on capital goods. You'll be, I mean, you're spending everything on consumption goods. You just go out, say, and buy all sorts of goods that you want, but you won't be, you won't, there won't be any money to invest in producing capital goods. In order to have production capital goods, you have to save up, and then you're able to invest and produce the capital good. And then, so we can conclude from this, and this is both Mises and Hazlitt emphasizes, that savings is essential to prosperity. If you want the workers to do well, then you have to, you need to encourage savings. Now, some people say, well, look at all these rich people around, like Bill Gates with billions and billions of dollars. He doesn't really need any of that. Wouldn't it be a good idea to just take money away from him and give it to the poor? He'd never miss it. And what both Mises and Hazlitt point out is that if you think in those ways, you're missing the really essential point of what's involved in someone having wealth. When you say something like Bill Gates doesn't need all the billions of dollars he has, you probably mean something like there are only so many goods, consumer goods, he can spend it on. He could buy a very big house or many big houses, or but after he does that, there'll be also a lot of money left over, and he won't have anything to consumer goods he can spend it on. He can use that money to spend things on. But that's just the point, that the rich person is perfectly aware of that, and in fact, most of their money is not spent on consumers' goods, but saved, and that money goes into investments, and investments is producing capital goods, which go to increases the productivity and then the prosperity of workers. It thus turns out that the wealth of the rich is really helping the workers, because it's being used to increase the amount and availability of capital goods, which is the principal determinant of the workers' productivity. and hence their wages. So we have kind of a parallel argument here. Is Mises first saying it's not the small group of capitalists that really run things, it's really the consumers, and consumers are mainly workers, so it's really workers who are running the economy. Now he has a parallel supplementary argument. He said, look, if you think these rich people are taking away money that could go to the poor and to the working class, in fact, almost all their money is really benefiting the poor because it's being invested, and investments are going to help the workers by increasing the number of capital, the amount, number of capital goods, and I mean, types of capital goods. Now, as you probably know, the view that Mises held and other Austrians held about savings isn't the one that's universally held by economists. Those of you, maybe there are some in this group, do any of you read Paul Krugman's columns in the New York Times, or do people have a look at him? He wouldn't be one who, he would disagree with at least a large part of what I was saying before. And he's following, of course, the famous economist, John Maynard Keynes, wrote a famous book in 1936, The General Theory of Employment, Interest, and Money. And Keynes and his followers criticized saving. I would say, look how good savings are, because you need savings to, in order to come up with capital goods, you need capital goods to increase the workers' productivity. But Keynes said, well, that argument isn't totally wrong, but there's a problem with it. And what is the problem that they found with this argument? They said this argument is assuming that money that's saved, that's say not spent, you save money by not spending it on consumers goods, that you just don't spend it, so you have the money there that you've not spent. Then the objection, at least this is one of the objections, they have others as well, they say, well, this argument is assuming that the money that you just hold back from consumption is going to be invested. Then you say, well, then you invest the money and then it'll go to increasing capital goods. But one of the Keynes' points is, what if it doesn't go into investment? What if just people just hold money? They don't invest it. They just think prices are going to fall, so they just hold the money, hoping that, expecting prices to fall, and they say, well, we're not going to spend the money now because we think prices will fall, and then we're going to spend it later. And according to them, if people do that, they just hold the money, this will depress the economy. Now, this argument isn't really right in its own terms, but we're not going to go into the problems of that argument right now, but I just want to give now, this objection is people might not invest the money they hold back from production, so then you won't have this process take place that I talked about before, where people are getting just building, producing more and better capital goods. So the part I'm not going into is just this claim that if people hold money, this will depress the economy. What I do want to mention is Hazlitt's discussion, where he really doesn't challenge the Keynesians on the point that a sudden change in the rate at which people save can cause disruption. Now, there is a way to challenge that argument. That isn't what I'm going to talk about now. What Hazlitt is addressing is another claim, which is, I think, very that interesting one. He says, what if people just, we're not talking about sudden changes in people holding money. What if people just hold money and don't do anything with it? That's called hoarding. They just, maybe they put the money in their mattress or buried in the backyard, so they're not investing it. So we're not considering changes in hoarding, but what if people just over a long time withdraw money from the economy? Hazlitt considers various kinds of saving. One he calls rent saving, and he's something like you're saving up the money not just for paying your rent, but just for everyday expenses. And he says it's clear that doesn't cost money. Say you just keep, you don't, say you get your monthly or weekly paycheck, you don't spend it all at once, but you save, you keep some money on hand so you'll be able to pay your expenses. That clearly doesn't cause any trouble. But the more interesting category is what he calls rainy day saving. That would be a case, suppose you save money, you just hold money, I don't mean you're putting it in an investment bank, you just keep money back, you just say put it aside because say you want to be able to deal with an emergency years that might not happen for years. You want to save for your retirement. So you just keep a lot of money out. You just withdraw money. Now, is that going to cause a problem for the economy? You say, well, people are just with taking money out. And Hazlitt said, no, that really isn't going to cause any problems over the long term, because what will happen there is that's just changing the pattern of spending over time. Say people are going to spend money they got, not right now, but later on when maybe when the emergency they're thinking about comes about or when they get reach old age, then they'll start spending the money. So that's simply a change in the pattern of spending over time. And then the last kind of saving is what he calls capitalist saving. And that's what we were talking about before, where you're putting your saving into investment. Say you're giving it, putting it in a bank, then the bank is lending it to investors. So that's actually beneficial. And Hazlitt said sometimes people thought, at least maybe they thought in the past, capitalist saving was only for the very well off, but in fact that's not true, that most people who save in a bank, it could be very people without who are not well off at all, are engaged in capitalist saving. If you have money in a savings account that's being used by the bank to lend to people, then you're engaged in capitalist saving. So Hazlitt, and I'm sure Mises agrees with him, concludes that saving doesn't pose any real problems for the economy, so you'll not be surprised to learn that Krugman was wrong, as usual. Okay, so I think that's the, we'll end right now, so we can now have, the rest of time will be, you have for questions, comments, objections, anything else? Wait a sec here. Now, Kenya McNaught says that I do not understand how capital goods increase worker prosperity. Okay, you want details. Okay, suppose the worker's prosperity will depend on how much money he gets from the employer. Suppose you say, you imagine you're working for a certain company, so you want to know how will the employer decide how much money to offer you. Well, it'll depend, obviously, on what you can do for him. I mean, employers, remember, I don't know if you know the great P.G. Wodehouse novel, was one of the great comic writers, and there's a character, he has this, some of the novels are about a character named Bertie Wooster, and he has a butler named Jeeves, and Bertie's rather on the simple-minded, and Jeeves is the clever one. So one time, Bertie and Jeeves go to Jeeves' club. They usually go to Bertie's club, which is called the Drones Club. But this time they go to Jeeves' club. And someone says to Jeeves, whenever any question comes up, whenever anything comes up, I always ask myself one question, what's in it for me? So that attitude is exactly what the employer is going to think. If he's deciding how much to pay the worker, what is the worker doing for me? And that will depend on how productive the worker is. How productive you are. If you're very productive, then you'll be doing more for the employer, so the employer will offer you more money. And if you have capital, say there's an increase in capital goods, I mean you have more and better machines and tools available to you, so your productivity will go up. So that's how the capital goods increase workers' prosperity. You see, once you think about it, you see it's quite easy to understand. It's just that the capital goods make you more productive. If you're more productive, then you'll command a higher wage, other things being equal. Now, Matthew says, I think I read somewhere that Rothbard did not agree with Mises' consumer sovereignty argument. Is that true? Well, what Rothbard objected, he thought that he didn't disagree with the basic idea Mises had that under the free market that the businesses are aiming to earn profit. So in order to earn profit, you need to produce what the consumers want. That's the way to earn money. You certainly agree with that. But he didn't like the word sovereignty. This actually, the phrase consumer sovereignty, comes from an article by W.H. Hutt, who was a English economist who taught in South Africa for many years. But what Rothbard said, well, it isn't, the consumers aren't sovereign in the sense that they can order the capitalist to do something. They can say to the capitalist, look, we order you to produce this. It's just that the capitalist will find it in his or her interest to produce in that way. But a capitalist can say, I don't want to do that. I'm just going to make it do things my way. And if you don't like it so much for you, it's too bad for you. The problem there is, if the capitalist does that, he'll tend to lose business to other firms that are cater more to what the consumers want. So Rothbard's objection is not to the real concept that Mises is talking about, but he doesn't like the word sovereignty. And you'll notice in the lecture I didn't use that, but you're very right to call attention to what Rothbard said, because the word sovereignty is misleading in suggesting it's a legal relationship. It isn't that the consumers can say to the capitalist, you must produce this or we'll put you in jail or fire you. It's just, it's in your interest to do that. businesses generally want to do what will produce profit for them, so they're going to find that a very strong incentive. Now, Peter says, could you please explain the difference between capital and capital growth? I read in one of Kurzner's books that there are different things. There's a difference of capital increase, workers' prosperity, too. Well, capital goods are the actual tools and machines that are used to in production. Capital goods are goods that are used in producing other goods. And capital means the value in money of those capital goods. So capital is a term for the money value of the goods. So generally an increase in capital would increase workers' prosperity, because if the capital good is more value, has a greater, if a particular capital good has a greater value, that will tend to increase the product of the value of the product that the worker makes on it. So, but the main thing to consider is that it's the capital goods that's making the worker more prosperous. The effect of just an increase in the capital, the value, the monetary value of the good, would be more indirect, although I think it does also play some role. The principal thing to remember is it's the capital goods, increase in capital goods, it's the increase helping the workers. You see, the distinction is capital goods are the actual machines, the tools, and capital is the money value of those goods. So they are very different things. You can add up. You can't add up capital goods. You can't say, well, how much is this machine in this factory, this machine here, and another completely different machine here. They wouldn't add up to anything, but you could add up the capital. You say, you talk about an increase in capital, an increase in the money value of these goods. Yes, we still have some time. I'm still the battles with Max Walensky against Rothbard are still continuing, if anyone is following those. Now, Peter says, isn't it subjective? It isn't what subjective? Isn't wealth subjective? It's certainly right that people value goods depending on their own assessment of what they want from them. But in general, when we talk about an increase in wealth, we just mean something like an increase in monetary income. And we're assuming that people want that, as most people do. So as when people talk about wealth in economics, they usually don't mean just the subjective well-being of people, but they're talking about when people talk about increase in prosperity, they just mean an increase in the money or the goods available to people. And the reason for that is that most people do want those things. So Kevin figured something out just now, which I'm glad to hear, but I'm not sure what it is that you figured out, but I'm glad you figured it out. Unless, of course, it turns out to be something like, you figured out how to get rid of me, then I'm not glad you figured that out. Oh, I see. I didn't see that. Oh, okay, so that was basically similar to what Peter was asking. Wait a second. Well, I'm glad you were thinking of that rather than thinking of how to get rid of me. That wouldn't make you too wealthy, even if you did that. Now, Kevin says, do you think that Wenzel's argument regarding the scarcity of ideas in some way undermines the anti-IP argument? What a fun debate that was indeed. Well, that's it. IP, I think I better not get into IP in this course. It's too controversial. It was a very funny debate. I think, as I recall in that debate, Stefan Kinsella is using scarcity to mean non-rivalrous in the sense that I can use an idea that doesn't prevent you from using it. But I think Wenzel means something else as scarce good as one that has a price. And Kevin, yes, I mean, that was a... It was a lot of shouting in that debate, but I think it's all right to continue to ask questions on my lecture too. I can't do. I'm not going to try a Wenzel imitation. That would only create trouble for me. Now, Matthew says, in Marx's class theory, something he came up with, or did he adopt the ideas from early things? Well, Marx actually had read some of the French classical liberals like Charles Comte, Charles Dumoyer, and historian Augustin Thierry, and they had a different view of class from the one he had, that when those writers were talking about class, they distinguished between when they talk about people being exploited, it was really those who had control of the state who were taking economic goods from the producers, similar to, say, what you get in contemporary libertarian theory, you get in Albert J. Nott, Franz Oppenheimer, and others. But Marx's theory is that the certain producing classes are themselves exploitative, the capitalist, the relation between capitalists and workers is one of exploitation. Although sometimes in Marx's work, he takes over the view that the state is an instrument of exploitation. But basically, Marx had read other people, but he had a modified and changed, I would say changed for the worse, what he got from those thinkers. Okay, Danny, I was going to say, yes, Ralph Rako is referred to an article by Ralph Rako has a whole collection on the French classical, writing on the classical liberals. He's the leading authority on the history of classical liberalism. Now here's one from Leslie. Some persons criticize capitalism because it led to a decline in craftsmanship in work. In traditional society, a worker made all of a good, whereas in a factory, he or she does the same mechanical operation day in and day out. Work in traditional society was meaningful, in modern society is mechanical and alienating. What are Mises' arguments against this view? Well, of course, that was an argument that you find in a lot of some of the 19th century critics of capitalism, like John Ruskin, who was a great art critic. Now, there's several points there that, first of all, there are certainly high quality craftsmanship display. You can buy goods today that are handmade or produced under high standards of craftsmanship. It's just the problem there is that they're very expensive and most people can't afford them. So capitalism doesn't end those. It just makes other goods available to the masses. So it isn't ending craftsmanship, it's just adding things to craftsmanship, but not getting rid of craftsmanship. So the situation isn't, well, in the old days when we had these craftsmen, everybody was getting really high quality goods. It was just, there were some people getting very high quality goods, but most people were getting nothing at all or very bad goods. Now we have everybody gets goods, and the high quality goods are still available. Now the other point on work being mechanical, well, I mean, some jobs are more interesting than others, but your life isn't, say if you have a job that isn't very interesting, your life isn't determined by just what you do on the job. You'll be earning money in that job so that you can do other things in the restaurant. Murray Rothbard in Power and Market and also in Collection Freedom, Egalitarianism and Revolt Against Nature has some discussions at this point on this alienation argument. In the second volume of his History of Economic Thought, he discusses the whole idea of alienation as found in Marx, so I recommend those things. So I say on this crafting, there are some people who they use any stick to beat capitalism with, in this case, apparently a well-crafted stick. Maybe I should try to get more people in this course. Maybe I should ask both Stefan Kinsella and Bob Wenzel to give guest lectures. That would really draw in the crowds, don't you think? Ah, Kevin said maybe together. That would be too much to hope for. Then we'd have to distribute earplugs to everybody. Yes, that would be it, Erlanda. Matthew, could you point me to a good book on the Industrial Revolution? First, there's a very good collection of essays edited by Friedrich Hayek called Capitalism and the Historians that came out, I think it was in 1954. Then there's a short volume by T.S. Ashton, who was a British economic historian at the University of London, that's called the Industrial Revolution. Then there was there's quite a bit. There's one economist that I was thinking about. What is his name? Begins with an H. It'll come to me in a sec. I can never remember anything anymore. I met this man in 1979. He was a very good historian. But it'll come to me. What was his name? I'll think of it. When Danny was recommending some other good years. And there's one by, I think Eric Jones has a good book also on the rise of the West. David Landis, L-A-N-D-S, is another writer on Industrial Revolution who would be good to read. Comes a very familiar with Lark and Roses, but the most dangerous superstition. No, I don't know that one. Could you tell me a little bit about it? Sounds very vaguely familiar, but I'm just not recognizing it. Someone has mentioned Hobsbawm, Eric Hobsbawm. Eric Hobsbawm was a longtime member of the British Communist Party, and he, I would say, is not very reliable on Industrial Revolution. And in fact, if you look at Hobsbawm's book dealing with the history of Europe in this period, he doesn't even cite Ashton in the bibliography or any of it. He just gives the Marxist position in it on it. So I think, I mean, you certainly should read him if you want to get that point of view, but it's not one that I would recommend for giving what I think is the correct view of Industrial Revolution. But he was a reading historian. Now, William Jutt says, I found the ethical arguments for capitalism mostly from Atlas Shrugged to be the best critique of socialism and communism, excuse me, or any other form of collectivism. My question is, are there any arguments that have been effectively for collectivism against capitalism not based on illogical information, or rather the collectivism pose that capitalism doesn't necessarily have an answer to? Well, I don't think the arguments for collectivism in general are very good. I mean, there's some that are better than others. Like if we look at the G.A. Cohen, the British Marxist, is a good one. He'll give you some good arguments that need to be considered. Oh, I see that this Rose of Tax Protester and Anarchist. Well, I'll have to have a look at that one. Oh, and then Danny points out that Ralph Rako has a good section on this, all a good bibliography on Industrial Revolution also. Let me just wait 1 second here. Wait, let's get back here. Okay, we have time for at least one more question if anybody's got anything. Well, all right, I guess we're about out of time now. Oh, now, Leslie says, what were Keynes' views on Industrial Revolution? Well, he tended, I don't know that he addressed this question how well the workers were doing. He tended to think that the Industrial Revolution had been caused by that inflation had helped promote economic prosperity. So I think he tended to have kind of an inflationist view of things. Now, William says, is there a way for a state to coincide a welfare program without destroying private enterprise? If not, what would be the best way to deconstruct the criticism to a purely capitalist one? Well, that's a very difficult question. I'll try to come up with an answer for that, but that would require a great deal of, I wouldn't have a fast answer for that one. I mean, I think they should just try to phase out the welfare programs in the speediest way possible. And I don't think you could have a welfare program that didn't have a negative effect on private enterprise. Okay, well, thanks everybody. Thanks for coming. Hope to see you all next week. Thanks a lot. Bye.